You are listening to Le Breakdown. This is Yasser Louati speaking. This podcast is offered to you by the CJL, Committee for Justice and Liberties. We are an independent human rights and civil liberties organization thanks to our donors. If you too would like to support our investigative reporting, political education and mobilization work, you can make a donation on cjl.org. Welcome to The Breakdown. This is your host, Yasser Louati, speaking to you straight from the Paris Southside banlieue. After Jonathan Brown speaking to us about Muslim minorities in the West and this comparison between French Muslims and American Muslims, I am pleased today to bring to the show another thinker from Muslim minorities in the West. Her name is Maryam Masmoudi, who is a civil society activist working for democratic governance and religious freedom in the Middle East and North Africa, among other things. She also writes on critical political and social theory, comparative democracy studies and Islamic and comparative religious studies. The reason why she will be joining us on the show is because of a text she wrote back in 2018, Ramadan, the month of anti-imperialism. And the goal here is to have a conversation on what would be a Muslim proposal for a more just or more just Western societies, whether you are in North America or in Europe, and at the same time, how to come up with a proper Muslim ideology or theology of liberation. We see that ever more Muslims are concerned with the questions of social issues, climate change, corruption, police brutality, Islamophobia, of course. But at the same time, we see that every single time we have organizations adopting this or that ideology. But is there a room for a Muslim-centric ideology of liberation that would frame what it means to struggle for social justice without rejecting the others? But just as you have, for example, socialists, communists, anarchists, conservatives fighting for social justice, what could be a Muslim proposal for these issues? Maryam Masmoudi, welcome to The Breakdown.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So to get started, I noticed you through first on your Twitter feed, Maryam Masmoudi, and this text you wrote, Ramadan, the month of anti-imperialism. Are you trying to provoke people, or where did this come from? Just to equate anti-imperialism and fasting and praying during the month of Ramadan?
That's a great question. Yes, I was trying to provoke people a little bit. I struggled with trying to title this article because I didn't want, you know, the title to be something just, you know, generic, a typical sort of religious title about the month of Ramadan, just another article about Ramadan. I wanted a title, and I think I found it, a title that that invited people to reflect deeper on the month than perhaps they may have through other works. Anti-imperialism to me is bigger than just the colonial period, for example, economic exploitation. It is those things, of course. But anti-imperialism relates to Ramadan in this way, in that it's also about, rejecting a lot of the negative, I think, impacts that we're seeing of modernity. Not all of modernity, of course. That's not at all what this article is about, but it's about responding to the negative effects that we're seeing of extreme and hyper consumerism, of a focus on the material over anything and everything else, and coming back to that with something better. I think as Muslims, we absolutely have something to offer and to respond to and to contribute, not only to Muslim societies, but indeed to non-Muslim societies where many of us live as minorities. I think we have a great deal to contribute, and we do ourselves a disservice, I believe, by shying away from that or flying too low under the radar and just trying to, you know, simply blend in or fit in. Although, you know, of course, I understand that impulse, but I think, you know, it's high time that we think more seriously and critically about engaging with our faith. And I think Ramadan is a perfect time to do that.
I'm going to start quoting you, and I really loved these extracts. Open quotation marks, our assimilation in the capitalist structure via globalization, corporations now slap halal marketing labels on meat, finance, clothing, and more. Oftentimes, and I'm speaking from a French perspective, maybe in the US it could be different, but when Nike, for example, came up with a hijab for Muslim women, people were extremely happy. They never thought about the sweatshops, you know, in the Philippines or in China or Vietnam, etc. Never thought about the destruction of the environment, but they stuck most of the time to, there is an acknowledgement that women are human beings like others who can work out.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, France is the laboratory of Islamophobia by far, that many of the rhetoric you see around the world targeting Muslims has been manufactured in this country. Yeah. How do you address people who would be, for example, happy that a brand, Nike, for example, would acknowledge their existence? Of course, their existence as clients, people who would buy their products. But nevertheless, a corporation will acknowledge their place in Western society, whereas governments tend to tell them, you don't exist. In France, as you know, I mean, like, you know, you pretty much follow what's happening here. Wearing a headscarf is a social death sentence. How do you tackle these two extremes?
So first of all, I want to say that I grew up, obviously, I think you can tell from my accent, I grew up in the US. I grew up also in a non-Muslim society. I'm sure in many ways different from France and from other European countries, but in a lot of ways very similar. So I certainly understand the desire to want to fit into your surroundings. I think it's a normal human impulse. However, you mentioning sort of the Nike hijab, a couple of years ago we had, you know, these extreme, you know, high fashion, haute couture houses like Gucci and all these different coming out with abayas, and, you know, they had a Ramadan collection. I don't know if you recall that. And people were also very excited about that. And I do understand that on one level, but like you said, like you hinted, I also think that that level of excitement of you know, yes, representation is important, and it is exciting to finally see yourself represented as a minority. You know, it's nice to see yourself represented in film, in popular culture, et cetera. But you know, it's important to think about what the costs of that representation are, and who and on whose terms are you being invited to the stage, and are you really being invited to the stage? So in the context of, for example, you know, this clothing, so Nike's hijab, or, you know, abayas by these, you know, high fashion brands, it's to me, it's kind of a diversion. And of course, it's also a ploy. You know, these companies, they're not charities, right? They're not running a charity and just trying to, out of the goodness of their heart, although certainly there are, you know, good people who recognize that there is, repression of minority voices, and they find an opportunity that matches with their own goals, which is profit maximization, naturally, for any, you know, massive corporation. But I think our job is to meet that kind of opportunity, like, this hijab, and just respond to it with, sort of our own independent and critical thought. And I think that we need to be very careful about how we engage, not only with these things, but with anything in life. We cannot simply embrace these things while ignoring the costs that they're having on our, you know, communities here in the West and also around the world, in the global South, as we refer to it. The costs of labor, the costs of pollution of the environment, the fabrics, where are those coming from? Who made those clothings, and in what conditions Did they make that clothing, or did they make that product? These are all really important and relate directly to our ethics as Muslims, wherever in the world we exist. When we separate ourselves in this way, we become just consumers, and we forget about the spiritual aspects of ourselves. We forget about the parts of ourselves that think about ethics, and we relegate them only to prayer, fasting, giving charity, all these different things, and we compartmentalize our existence. We lose, and we become followers, and we just become totally subordinate to a global system. In this case, we're talking about a global economic system that is all about fabricating demand, making you think you need something or want something through advertising and marketing, very aggressive advertising and marketing, and then profiting off of that fabricated demand and getting you to buy and purchase and feeling a very fleeting joy and happiness from acquiring material things, and just constantly being on that chase, for your entire life. We have a lot to lose from that. Not just our money, of course, and our resources and our time, but I think, and I put forth in this article, we're losing spiritually, we are losing ethically, and we are losing in terms of being contributing members to society. As Muslims, at the end of the day, we have something to offer positively. We have something to offer for others, not just for ourselves, for our societies, wherever we are living. And it's high time that we consider how we are consuming, how we are operating, how we are responding to these kinds of campaigns. Mm-hmm. That's what the article really is about. It's about responding to hyper-consumerism with hyper-critique.
Do you think there is a contradiction that could be overcome between having the joy of buying a product from a specific brand, and at the same time, you ask yourself, how about solidarity? Not only Muslim solidarity between Muslims, etc., but just solidarity with the people who have been exploited to manufacture the product. Do you think there is a need to further raise awareness in Muslim communities on what it costs to, for example, enjoy this materialistic way of life? Or you think it has to do with the way Muslims really envision their place in the world, that they cannot be happy by consuming and at the same time allowing that to happen to others? It's really, I know there is a deep contradiction, and this is because you can doubt. I speak to many Muslim leaders, etc., and oftentimes you see that for those who praise hyper-consumerism, they will just say the right to feel pretty, the right to live a comfortable life. And they will Islamize it and tell you, you know what? There is nothing wrong with that. Even if in terms of how I view my faith, there is nothing wrong with it. Yeah. But when you bring the question of, but what is the environmental or the human cost of that enjoyment? Oftentimes the conversation ends because there isn't really that connection between my well-being here and there. I'm going to continue quoting you, Maryam, and this is where, again, you have to to bear with me, because I really love the text, and I really encourage our listeners and viewers to read it. It's called, it's on the website, Traversing Tradition, and the title is Ramadan, the Month of Anti-Imperialism. You continue writing, Ramadan serves as a reminder of a life unbound by capitalism. Now, I don't know where you grew up, Maryam, but I grew up in the banlieue.
Yeah.
And capitalism was not necessarily seen as an evil. Why? Because when you don't have the access to material things and brands, etc., you don't reject it. You just long for those things. So oftentimes, and I grew up with that, and it took me years to come out of it and start to become critical of capitalism. Yeah, but capitalism is about freedom of enterprise. It's about employing people, that so they have jobs. It's about raising the standards of living. Yet here you are. Ramadan serves as a reminder of a life unbound by capitalism, one that does not require constant consumption to experience satisfaction. Now, again, many Muslims, if not most of them in the West, come from humble backgrounds, right?
Yeah, yes.
They live in modest communities, if not poor ones. So are you going to tell them you should reject capitalism before even having been able to enjoy it? And to finish, because we know the healing process of having been modest, if not poor. Soon yes. as your purchasing power Absolutely. Increases, you just dive into that hyper-consumerism. I need those brands. Some make it out and say, okay, I had it once enough. Some will just continue because their self-worth is pegged to that materialism.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So you threw a lot at me. I'm going to No, not at all. No, I think all very, very good points and really important to discuss. So first, I think as Muslims, we're not unique. We're not separate from the rest of, the societies in which we live or indeed any community around the world in that we are just as anyone else, fascinated by, engrossed by, and in many ways indoctrinated by these ideas, being pegged or pegging sort of happiness and joy and fulfillment and self actualization to acquiring things, material things, having things in your home. We're not unique in that regard at all. So this isn't something that is, this article speaks to Muslims, but I think also speaks to non-Muslims in a lot of ways in terms of, problematizing those relationships that we've come to accept as fact and as truth. I also want to say that I fully understand, and I have very similar experiences having grown up, that especially growing up non-Muslim, we weren't able to have the things that other people could have, or go on these amazing travels, or do Christmas, for example, and all of these, and how commercial Christmas has become. Especially in the US, I hope that's a little bit less in France, but definitely in the US, and our family struggled, just as I'm sure many others did, with trying to build a joy and an ambiance around Ramadan and around, the Eid celebrations as well. And a lot of that, I understand, it comes in the form of material things. So, decorations, food, very like extravagant meals, or, as nice as you possibly can, clothing and all of these different things, gifts, people try to compensate. I think that there's a lot of natural, innate human psychology that is at play as well here. But there's also the self, that is hungry for, recognition and at any cost, and that's hungry for, that's jealous, that is, that harbors negative emotions, that I think that we understand that when we separate it as nafs in Islam, and we recognize that that's bad. But then, why do we not recognize the similar phenomenon that is guiding our lives and controlling our lives in many ways, outside of, Islamic school or Islamic classes or reading the Quran, etc. I think basically, I wouldn't say no, we need to absolutely reject everything material and everything modern and everything that comes from modern capitalism or that we consume. That's absolutely not the case. I mean, I certainly don't live by that by that maxim, and I don't think anybody really can in the modern age or should. However, the context in which I wrote this article came up was basically, I started spending a lot more time in Tunisia, where my family is originally from,
And it was the first time that I was spending Ramadan in Tunis. And I was so excited, and I had all of these ideas about what Ramadan in a Muslim majority country would look like. And in many ways it matched, you know, that dream that I had, you know, going to prayers and gathering with family and all these different things. It was so exciting, right? But in a lot of other ways, I was really disappointed. I felt that there was too much emphasis on the breaking the fast. There was too much emphasis on what foods we were going to have. What are other people cooking, and how can we make ourselves unique? And how can we, you know, how can our predominantly women spend hours in the kitchen, you know, making these incredibly beautiful, delicious, diverse feasts that we can't possibly finish because we're, you know, our capacities for eating that much food is greatly diminished, of course, in Ramadan, as we all know. And that to me was a huge disappointment. And I saw that as something very material and as a waste and as a distraction. And so that was one sort of impetus. That was one drive for thinking, for myself, thinking more critically. I mean, I agree with you, yes, like we did not grow up. I would be surprised if anyone grew up believing or thinking in this way. But you are confronted by new, phenomenon. You recognize different things and you start to see and you start to problematize as you grow up older. And you're also we're all searching for, you know, how to make our marks. How can we be positive, constructive members of our societies? And I see this as being one way of achieving that. One way of achieving that is to say, hey, you know, what is Ramadan about? You know, step back and say, what is this month supposed to be about? Is it only not eating and drinking for, you know, 14, 16, 17, however many hours in a day? Is that all that it is? And then I break my fast and then that's it. I did Ramadan for this day. Or is it, does it include, and also, is it just, I say like just kind of, you know, marking that you fulfilled this prayer, you read this chapter in the Quran, you attended or listened to this lecture, et cetera. I would offer that it's even more than just that. I want to get to a point, and I'm speaking honestly to myself as well. I mean, this is, I think, a constant reminder that we all need, which is, you know, we need to be implementing the things that we learn and the things that resonate with us. If it resonates with you, that's a sign that this is something that feels natural and right, and that you should try to incorporate in your life in a bigger way, because that's where real fulfillment and joy and self-actualization comes from. These feelings of, you know, this is right, this is good, this is beneficial. And so, you know, having, when you start to recognize the attachment that you have to things, whether it be food or clothing or nice watches or phones and technology and cars and all, you know, all of these things that of course we all need to a certain degree, simply by virtue of existing in the modern world. You can't not have a telephone, you know, these days. You can't not, you know, have a car or all of these different things. Of course not. And I would never say that you shouldn't try to make Ramadan or Eid, you know, nice and enjoyable and something to look forward to for your families and communities. I mean, it's something that I do as well. I mean, I have Ramadan decorations up and all these different things. But we need to, you know, on the one hand, I think we need to think more critically about what halal means. So just slapping halal labels and just fulfilling a bare minimum requirement, I think we also do a disservice to ourselves.
To interrupt you, Maryam.
You actually brought
what could be the center of this conversation, the label sure. halal. So people limited yes. to the way you slaughter, you know, a sheep or a cow, etc., and that you yeah. have to name the name of God before doing so. And again, this sends us back to the example of the Nike hijab. Yeah. So,
yes,
is it still halal, for example? And I ask you, when the beast is mistreated, you know, when there is, you know, a destruction of the environment in, you know,
exactly,
you know, in the process? Or do you think halal actually coincides with more of an ethical way of life that includes, among other things, the proper slaughtering of the beast, but also proper care of God's creation?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely the latter. To me, halal is not just saying, you know, Bismillah or Allahu Akbar or whatever before you, and somehow that like magically transforms the activity that you're engaged in, whether it's, you know, halal slaughter or the, you know, a clothing that you wear, and we call it halal or Islamic and modest. And we forget about all of the horrible, in my view, very violent practices and realities that went into creating that. No, I don't think, you know, just saying halal or saying any word just magically makes it so. I think halal, like anything else, it reflects a set of ethics. And we have to think about, for instance, in the case of, you know, how we get our meats to our homes and to eat the, and to, you know, into our bellies. We have to think about the conditions in which those animals were raised, what they were fed, how the earth that they lived on was tended to, what, if any, chemicals went to, you know, all of these different things. So, you know, is our ethical farming practices, is that an Islamic, you know, cause? Yes, absolutely. I think it absolutely it is. And it's something that we have to think about. And it's directly related to halal meat and halal slaughter. And, you know, and halal meat and halal slaughter is not just that final act of, you know, sacrificing the animal and then, you know, cutting up their meats and selling that. That's not what it is. And I think that we do ourselves a disservice when we forget about everything else. It's difficult, yes. I mean, it's so hard in the modern world. If we're just talking about, you know, farming and meat production, I mean, this is including actually fashion. It's dominated by factories, right? It's dominated by huge companies. It's no longer small local farms as may have been the case in history, right? You know, it's real. So it is really hard to circumvent that existing infrastructure, or to try even to fix and alter and change what already exists, because it's so heavy and it's just, and it's mechanical. And unless you can provide a profit incentive, it's just not going to happen. But I think that we really need to think a lot more critically about, you know, what is in our meats. Is it halal if we're eating, you know, our lamb or our beef or whatever that has, you know, all sorts of toxic chemicals that may have, you know, diseases in it that, you know, the animal suffered, maybe not at the very end, because that's what we contend, you know, goes into our ritual slaughter, but suffered throughout its life, was not able to be a proper animal and roam freely and be healthy and live a healthy life. I mean, as Muslims, we have to care about every living creature, not just our fellow humans, not just our Muslim community, certainly our non-Muslim community, the entire globe, and all living creatures. We care about the earth. Islam has a lot to say about the natural world and the natural balance of the world. And we have to care about this. I also want to mention, you know, slapping halal or modest or Islamic on clothing like abayas and all this stuff is also not okay when that clothing is plastic and when it was made in factories and when it was produced, when it produced such harmful pollutants that go into our environment. Immediately when, you know, it's extremely expensive and unattainable from the vast majority of people. That's not halal. That's not halal clothing. I mean, is it modest? Is modesty, is halal, is Islamic dress or way of living, is it just an image that is devoid of meaning and of emotion and of ethics? Or are we finally going to have the difficult conversations and the difficult reorientation of our lives to say, no, it has to be both of these things. It has to be both the, it does have to be material. There is a lot of, you know, material image related aspects of Islam that we also do care about. We do care about what things look like, you know, of course, But we have to care. We simply have to care. And this is what I think we can offer to societies. We have to care about the processes by which things come to be, by which, you know, they come to our the shelves and the stores that, you know, where we buy them.
In the early 2000s, when Islamic banks were becoming more of a mainstream thing, we saw like Islamic banks rising, for example, in the UK. HSBC launched its own branch of Islamic financing. The Emirates also had the launching of, you know, the Dubai Islamic Bank, etc. And for us living in the West, we're like, oh, there's something good because that's a more ethical, you know, face of finance, etc. Like that oxymoron is somehow justifiable. Nevertheless, I came across, I had come like some years ago, across an article and an analyst who wasn't even Muslim. Like he wrote something like, yeah, and next time they're going to come up with is a halal distillery where you manufacture whiskey, you know,
because yeah, that's the next thing.
How can we, you know, how can they keep the same practices? It's always for profit. There is no care about the ethical use of the money, but they stamp it, you know, halal Islamic, and they double or triple the rates to the end consumer who happens to be a Muslim, as you said in your text, just looking for a way to remain within, you know, the boundaries of what is lawful Islam. Don't you think halal has also become a way to render Islamic all the excesses of capitalism?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I could just end my answer there, but I think that's an excellent example. It is, and unfortunately, in many ways, halal has just become just a final stamp or seal of approval. And as like I said, I see it as something almost magical, as if we're like, if it's halal, then it magically transforms everything about it becomes halal. And no, it doesn't. Doesn't change what got us to this point. And it doesn't change all of the harms that were impacted and affected on our communities and on the world at large. The finance, you know, Islamic financing is an excellent example as well. There certainly is room for improvement, a lot of improvement, and Islam and Islamic values and ethics certainly have a lot to offer in the world of financing, absolutely. But it just must be more than simply, you know, taking the same infrastructure, the same processes, the same ideas, and just slapping Islamic banking on it, and just changing some of the words and titles into, like, you know, popular Islamic phrases that people recognize, and that's it. It's not you know, the goal that we have for our lives. I mean, we are here to make honest, sincere, true, positive change and impact in our world, in our societies, and to call a spade a spade. So when it's a harm, when it's a negative, when it is a bad thing, we have to recognize it as such. And if we don't, it's to our own, you know, error. It's to our own harm and injustice. And yes, absolutely.
You spoke about change, and I think we're going to conclude this conversation that I think people will find quite dense, and that's the objective. You spoke about change. The problem is, first, you came up with an intellectual framework to rethink about Ramadan. You also spoke about the morality of the month of Ramadan and the way the believer views himself or herself in the world, and of course, and how they evolve as minorities.
Yeah.
Now, how do you see that happening? Do you have a special message to send to the local community leaders, especially in the mosques? Because what many Westerners don't understand is that Muslim communities are centered around the mosque. That's usually the hub. And one of the problems that, you know, Western Muslims are facing is that all the new initiatives launched for better societies are launched outside of the mosque. For whatever reasons, this is not the topic. What message do you, if you were to address a congregation of community leaders, men and women, mostly men, imams and heads of charities, if they were to implement this change, it could be first beneficial to the Muslims at their individual level, at the community level, but as you said, also at the level of a whole society to combat the excesses and the gluttony and the obscene amounts of inequality?
Honestly, I don't think it's possible to do in just one address or just one message. The idea behind this article, and I think, and the idea behind what you're suggesting, which I agree with, I think takes a lot of thought. It takes a lot of effort. But in the end, is I think, and I hope that you agree, is worth it. It's worth that struggle. Why I don't think it's, you know, just a, you know, quick fix is because, like I said, as Muslims, but just as people who exist in this, in these modern societies, we naturally, just like everyone else, are consuming the same media, the same messages, the same advertisements, the same movies and cultural references and music. And it's all around us. You know, we go to the same schools, we shop at the same area. I mean, it's not as though we're living in totally different, worlds, right? So we're in many ways very similar to our non-Muslim neighbors. And I think that, our imams or our religious leaders in our mosques and Islamic communities, they are there to lead, but they also reflect the community in many ways. I mean, they're not, you know, it's not as though these are, you know, superhuman beings who are inherently bigger and better and smarter than us. They're just like us, right? They've just, you know, dedicated their lives in a different way than others have. So I think there needs to be a lot of unlearning. First, there needs to be some recognition of, you know, what is happening. Is there a problem? Do we see a problem? Do we feel a tension about Ramadan or other things, just in general, about sort of our Islamic ethics, how we're living as Muslims today? Do we see that tension? You know, where? And start a conversation around the recognition. And then the process of unlearning comes. I mean, as you know, Yasser, you can develop habits. Anyone can develop habits. It takes repetition, it takes time, but you can develop new habits at any stage of your life. Of course, it becomes more difficult later. Barring all of that physiological and psychological stuff, you can unlearn. Just as you learn something negative before, you can unlearn it and replace it with something different, but it requires time and it requires, you know, sort of dedicated focus and persistence. And so this is not at all like slapping a halal label on. You know, the solution to something long-term that has happened over generations and centuries cannot possibly be just slapping a label on, just saying, hey guys, all of this is bad, let's just change it. And people will magically, you know, follow. It just doesn't work that way, right? So there's a really long process. I would start, if I were talking to, you know, an imam or a religious leader in our communities, I would start by asking them, you know, looking at sort of what kind of messaging, what language do they use when they speak about Ramadan and how people should observe and how are they, and what the important aspects of the month are and how are they living that out in their own daily lives? I would also, you know, ask, yes, you know, it's a lot about the messaging and how people are relating to this, but I would also encourage them to challenge people. We don't want to just be meeting people at where they are. I mean, that's where conversations begin, and you absolutely have to, of course, meet people on their level with their understanding and frame of mind, but also, you know, elevate, challenge them to think beyond their limits. That's the purpose. I mean, imams who... they're nothing but teachers. They are teachers, they're leaders. We want them to play this role. We don't want them just to keep us comfortable and static, right? Their whole purpose is to elevate us, to show us a different way, a new way, a better way. And this absolutely needs to be reflected in that language. And honestly, I think that there are a lot of positive changes that we're seeing, not just in the Muslim community, but even broadly speaking. We started this conversation, you know, talking about, you know, new movements that have risen in the last decade. And so for climate change, for you know, workers' rights, and all these are very important issues, and they are also Islamic issues. These are absolutely, you know, ethical conundrums and questions that we as Muslims also have something to say about. And there's no reason at all for them not to be included in our khutbas, in our lectures, in mosques, in our classes, in our family discussions, because change starts at the individual level, and it grows and becomes sort of, you know, a community and a society. And I just hope, for me, Ramadan is, it is about, just like, you know, we speak about how Ramadan is about, you know, controlling your desires and controlling your, you know, impulses and reflexes and trying to replace them with better. Ramadan is in that same way, is an opportunity. It's a window of opportunity for us to, we're naturally taking at least half a step back from the life we normally live, at least in regards to, you know, partaking in lunch and dinner and, you know, coffee and all of these different things with people, you know, family and friends. At the very least, we are stepping back. I encourage us to step back a little bit further and just think about the effects that all of these are having on us as individuals, even just thinking about advertisements. I mean, we're all on online, we're all on social media, right? We're all on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and all these, and you're seeing messages and you're seeing ideas and you're seeing products and things constantly in your face. Let's just think about what happens to you psychologically on a psychological and even spiritual level when you see other people and they're laughing and they're happy and they have this thing, and you start to relate that happiness and that joy and that fulfillment to having that thing. And this happens in everybody, Muslim or not. And we need to recognize that Ramadan offers us an opportunity to step. I mean, it's literally giving us a chance to step back and to try what it is to just put some distance between ourselves and these things that have been forced upon us. And they are forced upon us through advertisements, through you know, all of this, this whole like world that we're living in. There just has to be more than this. We just can't be moving through life, consuming one thing, you know, consuming one thing and moving to the next thing. There's just so much more to it than that. We have a lot more to offer than that. We can't let ourselves and the world down by failing to live up to our own potential as individuals, as human beings, and as a community, and as an alternative, as a potential alternative to many of the harms that everyone recognizes, the harms in terms of the climate, the harms in terms of labor, the harms in terms of, you know, wealth inequalities and social inequalities. Now with the pandemic, we're seeing vaccine inequalities all around the world. Yeah. I mean, this is a huge, and this is directly related to large corporations and to profits and to, you know, sort of nationalism and you know, and all of this is something that we now in Ramadan can think very critically about, can realize that we have something to say about, and can begin to offer solutions. You know, I don't pretend to have those solutions myself, but I do think that we owe it to ourselves to take advantage of this opportunity that this month gives us.
Mary Masmoud, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Likewise, and I hope to have you back soon on these topics you deal with. I remind our listeners and viewers that you are a civil society activist, that you write on critical political and social theory. I'm also going to mention the brand that you launched. When was that?
Thank you. It was also around 2018, actually. Very
right,
recent.
So you preach and do. So
big year.
That's a good thing. So congratulations. Oftentimes on this podcast, and I've been very critical of the people who have this double discourse. They preach one thing and do the opposite, yeah, especially politicians. But in your case, you wrote that article about an anti-imperialist Ramadan, but you also launched a clothing brand called Tunique Oasis. which promotes ethical manufacturing, which promotes equality between the workers or the garments. Yeah. They are actually like Tunisian garments. So for all of you who want to you know, buy something, this is the first time I'm doing it. So I'm not really, I guess, but honestly, for the first time, I got something like a person who wrote and did actually put into practice her theory. So people can check you out on Twitter as well. Maryam Asmoudi on Twitter. Maryam, thanks again for being with us. Ramadan Kareem.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Ramadan Kareem to you as well. And to all of your listeners.
Thank you very much. You stay safe and happy. Of course, we are still in the midst of a pandemic, so we have to take care of each other.
Absolutely. As
for you, dear listeners and viewers, this show is over. If you think this podcast does deserve your support, please make a donation on cjl.org. We are independent, autonomous, and of course, we have no red lines in terms of promoting the truth wherever we find it. Thanks again for listening and watching, and talk to you soon. The struggle continues.